Well, so evangelism and discipleship online? Notice the inflection there, kind of a question mark. So, what I want to talk about first is, my computer's been going a little, there we go. I want to tell you about my vision. My vision is to see 1,000, maybe more, but 1,000 free grace missionaries. Now, these are not missionaries that necessarily have to climb into airplanes and traverse the oceans and talk to people in other languages, although we need plenty of those as well. These are missionaries who climb onto their couch in the evening, pull out their device, and they reach the indigenous people of the World Wide Web. And so the really cool thing about missions online is that you can reach so many more people, potentially. But there's a danger in it, too. You can numerically reach more people, but there's a real tendency to not reach them in the same way, with the same kind of human connection. And so when we look at our numbers, I mean, we're just talking about views and things like that. When we look at our numbers, we have to be careful in saying that this type of mission work is better because we have big numbers than this type of mission work. And so I'm thinking of what Paul is doing across the ocean, and I can't remember your name, but you said you are in the UK, is that correct? So we have some missionaries among us who are making personal connections with people overseas. We still need that, and in fact, I would say many of those situations, it's easy to be a lot more personal in those kind of things. But that's kind of my vision, is to see people kind of taking up the mantle and learning how to do that. And so, for me, I probably should tell you a little bit about my background. I have a couple of sites. These are for free. Y'all can grab these on your way out. But Questions from Atheists is one that that I run. Also, the back of this, there's a site on here called simplybelief.com. This is another one that we run, and I have one called explainingthebible.net. All of these have their kind of their own different, I'll say, audiences, and we'll talk a little bit about some of that as we go along. So let's just kind of define real quickly the difference between evangelism and discipleship, because they have to happen differently in different sort of spheres. So somebody want to kind of throw out some basic definitions of evangelism and discipleship? That's good. Love it. Very good. And so what's the minimum amount of time that evangelism can take? It can be as short as the amount of time it takes you to say the sentence, maybe John 3:16 or whatever it is. So it can be very quick. How long does discipleship take? I mean, just, you know, if you look at the back of this thing, we have this little phrasing that I like. Salvation is by faith. It cannot be earned, returned, or lost. Discipleship is by works. It is either rejected, neglected, or maintained. And then on the inside, it says salvation is a one-time event, but discipleship is a lifelong journey. So y'all grab one of those if you want. But the idea, evangelism being connected to salvation, is that it can happen very quickly. And what we find in the New Testament is that evangelism often happens in crowds, whereas discipleship often happens in more private settings. And so as we go along, we have to then begin to think, what is the equivalent of privacy online, and what's the equivalent of being in a crowd online? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. I wrote part of it. Bob Bryant wrote the actual, this stuff. And I wrote the kind of the lead-in stuff. Yeah. All right. We're going to have a good question and answer time, it sounds like. Okay. Let's handle that towards the end. So online, can it be done online? So let me just ask you that question. Is it possible to do this stuff online, to do evangelism and discipleship? Well, I sure hope so, because that's what I've given my life to doing, and so I sure hope so. But here's maybe the harder question to answer. Is it really easier online? I mean, a lot of people would say, oh, we can reach so many more people, but does that actually make it easier? And I'm going to go ahead and say, no, not necessarily, because what is on the other end of that internet connection is people. And people can still have the agency to refuse or reject or whatever. And so it's still people that we're dealing with. And if we forget that and we say that, oh, it's so much easier online, then probably what's going on is we're not actually connecting with those people. And so if you're not meeting resistance, well, you know, Jesus had some things to say about that. Now, I like this analogy that everyone has a megaphone with the internet. So you get your megaphone handed to you when you, you know, plug your Ethernet cable up to your computer and thinking, oh, great, I can now reach all these people. But then you find out that everybody in the room has a megaphone and they're all blaring at each other. And so it's just a bunch more noisy. And I had this idea for an illustration. I don't think we'll actually do it. But I had this idea of having somebody come up and then having everybody in the room talk at them. And the goal is, come on in, and the goal is to try to hear everybody in the room while they're yakking. It's nearly impossible. But then if somebody got real close to their ear while all that yakking's going on and said something in their ear, what would they hear? They're going to hear the voice that's the closest. And so the thing that I think I want you to understand from this is that when we're trying to figure out how to be heard among the noise, it's still about getting close to people. Now, that may not be a physical proximity, but the people that I'm closest to are they're going to be the people that listen to me. And so it's possible to build tight relationships online even though we're miles and miles away. It's just that closeness operates a little differently, but it's still about getting close to people because we need to build credibility when we're sharing the gospel and when we're trying to lead people through discipleship. So we still need to get close to people. And here's the phrase that I want you to take out from here, those of you that are going to jump into doing evangelism and discipleship online, that the destination is private messaging. Say that with me. Let's say it together. The destination is private messaging. Now, there's a reason for that. Because evangelism, as we said, can happen in a crowd. Sometimes it happens in private, obviously, but it can happen in a crowd. But discipleship happens almost exclusively in a smaller and more intimate setting. And so what that means for me is that when I'm discussing with somebody online, I always have it in the back of my head, how do I take this conversation to private messaging? Because that's where you remove the audience. So many of the debates and discussions online, they're happening in public where everybody's listening and the reputations are at stake. If you can remove a person from that situation, you remove a lot of the difficulties. And so what a lot of people see online is I will begin conversations with people that are commenting, but I will usually try to get them away from that into a private message. And it's no longer public, and they feel much more free to consider and think about the things that are being said. So the destination is private messaging. There we go. These are just terms. I'm not going to go through all these, but if you have any of these that you'd like to talk about, what I was thinking is jot them down now and maybe we can just discuss them, if any of them that are interesting to you, we can discuss them in a Q&A if we have time at the end. Most of these you could really pretty easily Google and find out, but there's some advantage to knowing these. You don't really need to know these to do evangelism, discipleship online, but being effective, sometimes it's good to kind of understand the mechanics. So, Jesus was an audience builder. Now, that's my term. Probably other people have said it. But Jesus built an audience around himself. And he had a very balanced audience. He had a knack for putting people in places of leadership where they were then leading other parts of the audience. He built this really balanced, really healthy audience. And if you think about some of the stories from the New Testament, there was even places where he ran other people off. He said at one point, "You got to drink my blood." He said that to a Jewish audience. You think some people left? It actually tells us that, yeah, some people left after that. I look at that and think, that was intentional. There was part of this audience where he thought, these guys aren't working. I need to push them away. And it tells us that they're going to make him king by force, and that wasn't his goal. So he had a knack for balancing the kind of audience that was around him. Sometimes he built that audience. Sometimes he ran people off. But when we start thinking about audience building, we need to look at Jesus' model and think about what does his audience look like and what worked and what was effective. And for us, what are we doing that isn't effective? And so I've got some ideas on that. As we build an audience on social media, this is mostly focused on social media. It's important to know the difference between what we would call native content and third-party content. Now, just so you guys know, I'm going to try to keep the technical stuff kind of short so we can actually discuss at the end and we can talk more about this. But what you got to understand about content that goes on social media is that the social media site has an incentive. And their incentive is money. And they don't make any qualms about that. They sell ad space and all this. So Facebook, I'll use Facebook mostly because that's really the biggest one. Facebook is making money when you share the gospel. I mean, that's a really interesting idea, right? If I share the gospel and it gets seen by a bunch of people, Facebook is selling ads right next to my presentation and they're making money. And we want that because that incentivizes them to share it with more people. And so native content has an even higher incentive for Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all these. And so let me just kind of explain what the difference between native and third-party content is. So do you guys know the difference between YouTube and Facebook? Right? Okay. So Facebook, you can now upload videos directly to Facebook. So let's say I have a video about John 3:16. I can upload it directly to Facebook and share it with all my Facebook friends from there. Or I can go to YouTube and I can upload it to YouTube and then I can share it into Facebook from YouTube. Now, which do you think Facebook prefers?
Native.
Because people don't leave Facebook then. Now, this applies for all social media networks. It applies for Twitter, Instagram, whatever. They want people to stay in their house. Because in their house is where they're selling their ads. And so they don't want you to go somewhere else. And there's actually, you can see this happening. If you ever do this, you know, you can upload one place and then upload it natively. They actually change the way that the post looks based on whether it's coming from somewhere else. If you share it native from Facebook, they give you this nice big thing that auto plays and they want people to look at it. If you share it from YouTube, they give you this little bitty square and it's got a little play button. You have to click it and it's just there. There's no question about it. They want stuff natively. So, what's the application for us? If you want more people to hear the gospel with whatever kind of post you're sharing, do it natively. And so what that means for me is if I've got a video about John 3:16 or whatever, then I have an account on YouTube and I upload it there, but I also directly upload it to Facebook, I directly upload it to Instagram, I directly upload it to Twitter. It's more work for me, but more people see it. And so that is what native and third-party content is. Now the other thing that we need to understand about these social network sites is they want to put the most interesting stuff in front of their, we can't exactly call them customers because it's not the viewers that are paying, but in front of their maybe constituency, they want to put the most interesting stuff. And so there's a set of priorities based on the type of content. And I bet you could guess what it is because it's the order I've put it in. So videos get seen more than images, and images get seen more than text. And that is, I mean, you can test that numerically. That is what happens. If you share the exact same message in text format, like you just type it into your status bar, share the same message in an image and share the exact same message in a video, the video is going to be seen more. The image is going to be seen more than the text, so on and so forth. So, what's the application? The application is that if we share native content on whichever site it is, meaning we upload it directly, and we upload it in a video format, then that is the best place that we can be sitting. Now, it needs to be interesting. It needs to be good if we, you know, have the means to do it. But that is the best, I'll say, content and the best chance that it's going to be seen. And really what we want is as many people as possible to see the gospel message. So, some of you may be asking the question, well, now, wait a minute, I don't make videos and I probably never will. You may say, I don't really write articles, I don't really do images, so what am I supposed to do? Does that just mean I can't share the gospel? Not at all. There's basically two kinds of people, well, I'd say there's three kinds of people, but two in consideration for us. There's content consumers online, okay? So content is just the stuff that we would post, that we would share. There's consumers, okay? But we're not talking about consumers. We're talking about those who want to share the gospel and do discipleship online. So basically, there's content creators and there's content curators. So what's the difference between a creator and a curator? Spelling is definitely different. And by the way, my spelling is bad sometimes. Curator. That's it. Yeah. Now, let's ask this question. What makes a good museum curator? Is it somebody that just accepts anything? Not at all. What is it?
Taste buds.
I like that. It's somebody who has taste. It's somebody who can spot something good. It's somebody who can spot something that other people want to see. And so I've got lots of friends on social media that will just share anything. And they don't think anything of it. This was kind of interesting, that was kind of interesting. They just throw all kinds of stuff up. But a curator, someone who's really thinking about this stuff, is somebody who's thinking about what I would call a basic set of little rules so that they can do evangelism and discipleship well. And so what those rules are, now, this is not an exhaustive list, but these are the things that came to mind for me, and that what I think basically describes most of the really quality content streams that I see on social media. First of all, is curiosity. You need to be able to generate interest. This one's a no-brainer. If you're sharing bland stuff, people aren't going to look at it, right? I mean, it's just, that one's pretty simple. One that's more important, but also, I would say, equally needed if you want people to look at it, is clarity. You need to have an identifiable message. So you could share videos of kittens all day long. But what's the message? I mean, maybe there's a message in that. I don't know what it is, though. It's not an identifiable message. If we want to share the gospel with people, they need to be able to see the gospel in the stuff that we share. We're not just sharing so that we can build an audience for ourselves. We're building an audience so that we can present the gospel to them. So, clarity and an identifiable message is really important. Another one is consistency. So I'll give you an example. This month, I've been pretty busy kind of prepping for this, and I just haven't had time to make many videos for this site, Questions from Atheists. And so on my social media, what I did this month is I just scheduled a daily post of old videos. And so I think we've gotten maybe 150,000 views just from rescheduling old stuff, just so that there's consistency, just so stuff just continues to be in front of people. And what happens is, a lot of people that hadn't seen it before see it this time. And so don't be afraid to share things more times than once if you kind of run out of things. And then I think probably maybe the most important, they're all important, but maybe the most important is conversational. And the way I'm describing that is you need to leave room for discussion. So what I see that as is you want to post things that are the beginning of a conversation, not the end. You want to post things that give you an opportunity to talk to the people that engage with it. And so if somebody leaves a comment, likes it, shares it, whatever it is, that is then your inroad to have a conversation with them. And so it's those four things that come to mind. There's probably other things, but as far as being a curator and someone who shares stuff, this is your on-ramp into these conversations to talk about the gospel. I don't know why it takes a second. Okay, there we go. So we want to engage with those who engage with your content. And so for me, this basically means when I post something and somebody shares it, I always try to say thanks. Now, sometimes there's hundreds of those and I just can't get to all of them, but I try to always say thank you. It's really easy to find those who've shared. I always try to respond to comments. Sometimes there's hundreds of comments and I just can't get to all of them. And so the way that I prioritize responding to comments, if there's a bunch, is I look for questions. Because people that are asking questions, that is, to me, a higher priority because they're possibly open and interested to having discussions about Jesus. And so that's kind of the priority for me if there's too many to respond to individually. And two rules that we're going to hit another once or twice is be kind and be patient. I am appalled at how most believers seem to respond to comments online. Now, these are self-proclaimed disciples probably as well in many cases, but I would say from the attitude, I often kind of wonder, how can you respond to somebody the way that you respond and say that that's loving? I'll give you a couple of examples, or I'll give you an example that happens often. Because of the content of what I'm doing on Questions from Atheists, there's a lot of debates on there. And there's people who claim to be believers who will pretty often say something to the effect of, well, all unbelievers are children of the devil. Now, is that technically true? Well, yeah. I mean, Jesus talked about that. But he said it to a specific group, a very rigid group, a group that probably needed to hear it. And so just like throwing that out in a discussion to kind of win the discussion, that's the kind of things I see often, and it just kind of makes me sad, because I'm thinking that's a missed opportunity. You probably could have been much more kind, much more patient with that person, but instead you called him the seed of the devil. So that is the wording that somebody said that this week. I was just thinking, we could have done that better, couldn't we? So be kind and be patient. So, let's see. Oh, I think I can click it right there. So I've been thinking a bit about how Jesus' audience sort of was, I'll say, structured. Now Jesus, like I said, Jesus had a very healthy, very balanced audience. And so I think it's really valuable to kind of think about how he structured the audience that he taught and that he interacted with. Now, I will say that this is, again, not an exhaustive pyramid. I would say there's another couple of strata in here that just didn't fit well on the screen, and, you know, we'll talk about them. But basically, the New Testament kind of gives us some numbers on kind of how his audience was structured. And so, 2.2 million, this is an estimation from the Israeli Board of Education or something. They have this great chart that has, you know, it says they think about that many people, that many Jews were alive in Palestine at the time of Christ. And so that is kind of the maximum possible audience, unless he was to leave the country, which we don't have any evidence that he did, other than Egypt. I guess he did leave then. It's neither here nor there. And then the crowds, and so we have instances where he fed 5,000, fed 4,000, he performed miracles for what it calls multitudes and things like that. And so there were lots of people that had sort of this nominal interaction with him at some distance. But then as you go up the pyramid, you get closer to Christ, it tells us some of the numbers. He sent out a group of 72 at one point to go and do ministry. And so those were people that were closer to him, probably heard him teach more often and things like that, and had, you know, possibly personal instruction from him, closer than this group. The chosen 12, you know who those guys are. And then the inner circle, there's a couple of instances where just a set of three got to see really cool stuff that the rest really didn't get a chance to see. And so that's how he structured his audience as far as we know. And it seems that this is very balanced, because the three could very well, and I'm making some assumptions here, but the three are a pretty good leadership team for the 12, and the 12 are a pretty good leadership team for the 72, and the 72 are a pretty good, you know, you could say, ministering team for a few thousand. I mean, 72 people can do a lot for, that audience. So there's some inferences in there, but that is how I sort of see him structuring his audience. And so that has made me think about, how do we structure our audience online and things like that. And so these may feel a little goofy, but since I'm online constantly, this is kind of what I see as some of the parallels to what Jesus was doing and then what we might could do online. And so each of these probably has parallels in the real world as well, but these are words that describe certain things that you'll find on social media. So reach, for instance, reach is the overall amount of people that your posts can touch. Now that doesn't mean they've clicked on them or anything. It just means that they've glanced at them. They've made a scrolled right by, but your reach is always going to be your biggest number. Your views are usually going to be a little bit lower than that by nature. And so your views will be those who either have clicked or they've paused long enough, a few seconds or maybe longer, to see your content and really kind of absorb it. Engagement is those who maybe have clicked like or share or even commented. Then discussions can happen in the comment section, but our destination is private messaging. So discussions happen both in the comment section and the private messaging. And then discipleship. You may say, well, now wait a minute, discipleship, where is that happening? Well, I'm going to submit to you that you can disciple somebody through private messaging and these other ways. And I'll explain how that's happening for me. I wonder how many times I have to hit the button to, I think I skipped one. Okay, so this is my numbers for 2016. And you'll notice that it's not nearly as balanced as Jesus' audience. His audience was so much more healthy, I think, in a number of ways. And I'll give you kind of an example. For us, it's really, it really appeals to the human nature to go after the big crowds. And so most people, when they talk about success, they're thinking about big numbers. And so in 2016, our reach was 11.8 million, which means that was, you know, our content was showed to that many people. Doesn't mean that many people had, it doesn't mean it had influence on that many people. It's just, that's how many people, glanced at it or whatever. Our views were about 3.5 million, mostly video views. And then the engagement was in the thousands, so that's people who have clicked or shared or whatever. The discussions are in the hundreds, but that's kind of even skewed because I'm counting discussions as just responding to a comment. Those doesn't necessarily mean that those discussions went anywhere. It's just people that I've interacted with in some way. And the people that I was actually discipling in 2016 and still am now was 3 to 4, and I say 3 to 4 because I can't remember exactly when the fourth started, but it was somewhere around the end of 2016. So from 11, nearly 12 million to 3. And that's how many were discipling out of all of this huge crowd. Now, Jesus' audience looked a lot better, and he had a structure where he discipled people that would then disciple other people. I'm still struggling with that. I'm still trying to figure out how to build that into the audience that we have online, and I don't have a good answer for that. I mean, I have a few guys that are really kind of stepping up to the plate and want to start doing discipleship themselves, but we haven't got there. So I'm just being transparent with you. I'm not exactly sure how to structure it in that way, but that's kind of where we are. So here's kind of, we already kind of talked about this, but basically, this is more public, that's more private, and what that equals to is often evangelism is going to happen out here where we've shared to a broad, sort of a broadcast format. That's largely where evangelism is going to happen out here, and discipleship is going to happen closer to the top. And what we notice is that the ones who are at the top of the pyramid are the ones that are closer. They spend more time with the person who's discipling, you guys. And so in Jesus's case, those who are at the top of the pyramid were the ones that Jesus gave lots of his energy and lots of his resources to. Now, he helped people all, you know, at all strata, but it seemed like the ones that he really poured himself into most were those that were very close to him. And for me, and I would say for a lot of us, we need to be very aware of this, that our tendency is going to be go after this big crowd, but often I think we need to flip it and say, let me invest in the few people that are interested in knowing Christ more and following him on a daily basis. Let's put our resources there and not worry nearly as much as about that big crowd. Now, sometimes it's because of the big crowd that, you know, you find people to disciple, but that's probably another talk. Deciding who to talk to. I'm almost done, and then we'll do some discussion. Deciding who to talk to. This took me a number of months to figure out, and my good friend John Clace, who shared a couple of times yesterday, actually helped me with this. After our first video that sort of went viral, we had a couple million views, and we had like 600-700 comments. I just wasn't sure what to do. I was like, Do I try to talk to everybody, or do I just ignore them? And so I sent a message to John Clay. He's just a very wise person and, you know, very familiar with the Bible. And he looked at the comments. He said, you know, I think a lot of these guys are mockers or scoffers, I think was the word he used, which is the word in another translation. But he said, Proverbs 9, this is what I love about John Clay. He just rapid fire. Proverbs 9:8 says, don't respond to mockers. It's like, yeah, that's the easiest answer. I mean, it was just so simple, so beautiful. And, you know, if you read those Proverbs, it gives reasons for that. But for me, it was just sort of a burden off that those who are responding just to poke us in the eye, we don't have to feel like that is our obligation to, you know, stand in the place of scoffers or whatever you want to call it. So a question that I will ask, and this is more useful on our site, Questions from Atheists. A question that I will ask pretty often is, if it were possible for me to prove to you that God exists, would you follow him? And I would say of the people that I've asked, maybe about 20% say no, because I think he's evil or I think he's hateful. And they'll cite some obscure verse from the Old Testament and, you know, give some thin explanation for that. But for me, what that tells me is, okay, conversation with you is a low priority. I don't necessarily just cut it off, but I know that what I want to do then is I want to spend time with people that would follow him if they could get over the, you know, whatever issues they're dealing with. And so those who just refuse to either refuse to believe or refuse to go further in discipleship, to me, that's going to be a lower priority conversation. And so that, from John Clayes, has kind of helped me decide who to talk to and how to prioritize those kind of conversations. A couple of rules for discussions with people online come from 1 Peter 3. So a lot of times what will happen for me is I'll watch our comment threads, and I'll look for people that I think would be really good to have conversations with. There's a lot that don't look like they'd be good to have conversations with, but you get to noticing certain names that kind of come up often who respond well or maybe are asking questions. And so a lot of times I will then try to take those people and go to our destination, which is private messaging, and take them and begin to have a conversation over there. And what I'll usually try to do is I'll try to ask questions relentlessly. Now, that's my little phrase that basically means I want to show you that I'm interested in you. It's not fake. I really am interested. I want to show you that I'm interested by asking you lots of questions. And in this phase, there's no debate. The person can say whatever they want, and I'll say things like, I see where you're coming from, or I understand what you're saying. I'm careful not to use words that imply that I'm actually agreeing, but I refuse to get into an argument at this phase, because at this phase, I'm letting them know that I care, and I'm also building some credibility, building a relationship. And here's something interesting that's written into most people's DNA. If you ask enough questions, eventually they're going to turn around and say, what about you? What do you think? And then I put into practice 1 Peter 3:15, which says, be ready. Do you know it? Can y'all say it? There you go. And it's an answer only if they've asked. For me to cram it down their throat, that's not an answer. That's me cramming it down their throat. If I can engineer a situation where they ask me to tell them, then I can do what this verse says. I can give an answer for the hope that's inside of me. But then it says something really important right after that. In NIV, it says, with gentleness and respect. He says we need to be ready. But what I think he's telling us here is if you can't do it with gentleness and respect, then by definition, you're not ready. Part of being ready is being able to do it with gentleness and respect. And so at that point, when someone asks us what we think, we've built the situation to where they feel comfortable asking a question, then they ask, and then we use gentleness and respect, and we have a very good answer. That's a big part of it, but we're at the GES conference, so I know you guys have great answers for things. And so we give them that answer with gentleness and respect. And then the conversation may go back to me asking questions relentlessly again until they ask again. And then at some point, it balances out. But somebody who's skeptical about you or skeptical about your Jesus, it's going to be hard for them to have a normal conversation at first if you've started that. And so what I thought for a long time is that I would find disciples, people to disciple by doing this. And what's interesting is, I haven't yet. But I do have a few people that I'm discipling. So I want to tell you how that happened. I thought it would be by this process. I envisioned this and I thought, I'll seek these people and they'll get better and better and better. And then but that's not actually what happened. What actually happened was a little bit different. I began to pray about having a few people to disciple. A couple of young guys maybe that are wanting to know more about the Bible, they're wanting to obey Christ more, things like that. And so I began to pray about that because I'm looking at Matthew 28 and Jesus is telling me to do it. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not really doing it as far as I know. So Lord, would you help me do it? And it sort of took me by surprise. It's just occurred to me recently that what's happened over the last few months and, you know, last year, I guess, was really an answer to that question. So I want to remind you of what happened in John chapter 1. The first disciples of Jesus actually pursued Jesus. Now, most of the time, if you ask somebody, how did Jesus call his disciples, they're thinking of the incident by the Sea of Galilee, right? They're thinking about Jesus coming to them and saying, come follow me. But if you read that right next to the first chapter of John, I'm going to submit that the first chapter of John actually happened before that incident. And you guys are probably smarter than me, but just the way I look at it, that's how I see it. And so it seems that in the first chapter of John, what happens is two of the disciples of John the Baptist actually follow Jesus around and say, Jesus, where are you staying? We want to hang out with you. They're pursuing him. And then Andrew goes and finds his brother and is like, hey, you got to come see this guy. So these first disciples actually followed Jesus around. They got to know him because they pursued him. And so what I've come to believe about discipleship is that, at least maybe in our modern era, I don't know if it's any different, but from scripture and my own experience, what I'm seeing is that discipleship seems to be student-led in some aspect, at least in the beginning. And that's been my experience with the guys that I'm discipling online, is that they have found me. Now, there's a particular reason why they found me. They found me because I'm posting things constantly, mostly on the subject of evangelism and talking about Jesus constantly. And so these, you know, a few young guys started sending me messages and asking questions about the Bible. And so that began what now is a year, in one case, a year and a half long conversation about growing, and we're accountable to each other in you know, some really cool ways. And so these kinds of conversations came not because I pursued them, but because I was doing some evangelism and they came and found me. And I see a real parallel between that and what some of the first disciples of Jesus did. And so I believe that we need to be praying for people that we can disciple. That may happen online. It may not. It may happen in person. And I think there's some benefit to doing it in person. There's some difficulties with doing it online. But there's not much that can't be done through writing back and forth and discussing scripture and talking about how we live. So, that may be my last slide. I have no idea how we're doing on time. There is a clock back there. So these are my these are the sites that I'm doing this kind of stuff on. And so what I want to do, I'm not actually sure when we're supposed to finish. Does anybody know that? I want to have a discussion because my guess is that 2:45. Oh, we got good time. Okay. Most of you guys probably have a lot more years of experience than I do. I just happen to be a guy that's doing stuff online, but I'm still learning a bunch about how to do ministry and how to, you know, how to figure this kind of stuff out. So what I would like to do, we'll call it a question and answer session, but really I just say, let's kind of discuss some of these things. And if you've got any questions about any of the technical stuff, I'd be happy to answer that. But I'd also like to hear your thoughts on, you know, whatever. So, yes, sir.
I'd like to raise an issue each end of a huge spectrum. One end, one-on-one, you'd never reach the world. Mm. The other end, reach the whole world really quickly.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that if there was a website that listed every language in the world, but only had one message, so that a person from Uganda or anywhere could go on the internet, pick their language, and get a precise, concise explanation of salvation and how to go to heaven.
Yeah.
I think that would go viral.
Yeah.
And I think it would be important to do it before somebody else does it.
Yeah.
That's leading people in the wrong direction. Like today, they say Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world.
That's
scary.
They
get this idea, they'll just go with it. But
yeah,
it's to our interest to put our message to every single individual
in the world
in every language.
Yeah. I love it. On our site, Questions from Atheists, we have a little app that, and I'm not sure if it's on the main page anymore, but it's a translation app. And so it's done by Google. And so you can go on there and you can pick what translation you want. Now, the problem with that is I don't read Arabic. So whether the translation's good or not, I have no idea. So there's some aspect of that, but getting it right and making sure that it, I love the idea, though. Really, really neat idea. Other thoughts? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think you're right on with that. You're talking about building a relationship with trust with people before you, and question, asking the right questions.
Yeah.
You start preaching and people switch off.
Yeah.
Real quick. I think you're right on target with that.
Yeah.
I'd like to qualify my statement earlier about salvation. I don't believe you can be saved more than once, or that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And I think evangelism is definitely a process of winning little arguments, if you will, arguments with people, or when it's arguments like over making a point over time.
Yeah.
It is a one time event.
Yeah.
But I agree with that, but I think it's kind of, there's also different lead ups of people making many, saying yes to different things in many scale until
I think that's right on. I think it's very accurate to say evangelism is a process. I heard somewhere at one point that the average person, and who, what's the average person? I don't know, but the average person has to hear the gospel 8 times before they accept it, and so, or they believe in it. And so, I don't even know how you do that research, but, whatever. But that's a reminder that, there's seed that has to be planted and it takes time. And yes, I totally agree. I totally agree. Yes, sir.
The video that went viral, was it a video? So,
I have some ideas. I wish I knew exactly. I come from a background. For about 7 years, I had a business where I made videos, and so I sort of pulled up to the table ready to do that. So the quality of most of what I'm doing, I think, is about at the same level. But some things get shared way more than others. It's stuff that's at the same, what I would say, the same quality. This one in particular, it had a very general message that a Catholic person could agree with, basically anybody in any denomination could agree with. The idea of it was basically that whereas most every other religion is based on a private event that is really difficult to verify, Jesus' life was lived out publicly and then it was shared by the public. Really good idea. I didn't come up with that idea. That was somebody else found online and I just made a video of it. And so it just really hit with a lot of people. And so what I notice is if I make a video that's on a free grace subject, the audience is much smaller, just by nature of, that's just how it is. And so, so those very general subjects, if it's a lot of the stuff on our, questions from atheists is a lot more general than the stuff on, say, explainingthebible.net, because explainingthebible.net and Simply Belief are, they're specifically devoted to explaining the Bible from a free grace perspective. And so those just are going to have smaller audiences. So I think there's a number of factors there. But yeah, that's a really great question. If I knew exactly, I would make more videos like that. But
you mentioned discipleship. Are you saying discipleship in a way that to duplicate the online evangelism? Or are you saying just discipleship in general as far as Scripture is concerned?
I'm not sure if I understand.
So we're disciples. Mm-hmm. I'd say everyone here, we're being evangelized to, of course, in information, but we're taking this information and then share it with the world that we, our little target market. But the idea is you're saying, okay, you're taking those 3 guys. Are you in any way teaching them to duplicate what you're doing online?
Yes. So I understand you now. Yeah. So I think of how Jesus worded the Great Commission that we're to teach them to observe all things that he commanded. So I wouldn't call it discipleship if I didn't have some influence in their lives. So I'll give you an example. There's a guy named Aaron that I'm saying I'm discipling him, but I'm also growing by having discussions with him. So it's not a one-sided thing. But for instance, I asked him a couple of weeks ago, hey, what are you struggling with? What are you working on? Where are you trying to grow? He shared some things with me. I shared some things with him. And then we both said, hey, let's pray for each other. And then let's talk again in a couple of days. So that's the kind of relationship we have. It's focused on, there's a lot of questions about what do these verses mean? But honestly, a lot of it is, how do I stay pure on the internet? I mean, I'm on the internet constantly, so we're talking about that kind of stuff pretty often. How do I stay pure? How do I avoid temptation? For him, he works in a factory. He said, I'm around profane language all day long, and I'm trying to stop. What can we do to try to be better? And so the questions that I wind up asking him pretty often is, what can we do to be better men? And that's the kind of stuff that we're talking about. And so that's why I call it discipleship, because it's very focused on obeying and doing what Christ wants us to. Yeah. Yes, sir. This is, so I work with 289 Design. There's a table down there. So I explain it to people. I'm a full-time media missionary, basically. So I view it as a mission field. It's just a mission field that happens to come to me rather than the other way around. So. Some, but I've gotten to where I'm not really doing that as much. But Amy, who's in the room, she works with 289 as well. She's a great designer and has a lot of ministry clients that she works with. So I don't know if you're looking for that kind of thing, but she'd be a great one to talk to. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to address the idea of the destination in private messaging. And my insides get a little scared about that. You know, the whole idea of staying pure, mm-hmm. Accountability, and just people that can hide behind private messages mm-hmm. and lead you into temptation.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I've made my wife an administrator on all my sites. So last night, for instance, I had a message I wanted her to look at. It was from a guy that was, well, he's mean. And it helps me to sort of share that and say, let's laugh about this a little bit, the mean things he said about us. You know, but that was a private message. And so it helps me to know that there's other administrators that can look at it and that at some points they might just happen in there. But that's a really good thing. And in fact, when I was a younger man in college, I wasn't prepared to do this kind of ministry because it's just a huge temptation. You know, and so not to say that I've overcome every aspect of that, but being married has helped. Having other people that can see what I'm doing online. I have locks on my phone that I can't go to certain content unless my wife types in the number, stuff like that. So there's all kinds of things like that that help me to just... I think of the Lord's Prayer where he says, sort of guide us away from temptation. And then if we get in temptation, deliver us from it, you know. And so so that's a big part of it. The other thing for me is that, no, I lost the thought. What, I think you had your hand one more time.
Well, just the idea of even the motives of the people that might be wanting to talk to you online. You know,
yeah.
So many predators out there.
Yeah.
That
would be hard for me to answer. I will say, this was the other thing I was going to say, I particularly don't engage women for the most part in private messages for that reason. Every once in a while I'll get a message and I'll respond and talk to them briefly, but the one that I'm thinking of recently, I've asked my wife to just kind of monitor that conversation. Just, not that there's anything that is going to go on, obviously, but it just makes me feel better. So I don't feel like I'm out talking to some lady while my wife is, you know, raising my kids. So, I like the idea that there's other eyes on it. And so I generally am focusing on men. I would probably always suggest that unless there's some extenuating circumstance I can't think of, but I'd say generally discipleship probably should be men with men and women with women, unless there's some reason not to. You don't know for sure, yeah, and that's a good question. But I think for me, it's just a matter of I'm going to trust unless I don't have a reason not to. If it's there is a guy who is transgender who has a female name. I think he was originally male, and so I feel comfortable talking to him, even though it is a Samantha. So it does get confusing. So it's, yeah, I agree. It's hard to know.
I recommend you putting in safeguards. My husband tries to teach young men, youth pastors, you know, not that you're going to do something, but there's always that possibility.
Sure.
So put in safeguards for yourself.
Yeah.
And know what those are. And the chance of the temptation falling in temptation is much less.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. And it's wrecked a lot of men's ministry. Well, and probably women too, but, you know, I've heard too many stories that, you know.
Oh, yes, they all have never happened.
Yeah.
But we've seen too many work happen.
Yeah. It's more of a trip than an intentional step, you know. It's just, whoops, you know, here I am. So, and that's not to say I'm above it, obviously. So, and the reason I need those is because I'm not above it. I mean, that's exactly the point. Yeah.
Do you stay anonymous?
So on, it depends on our Facebook pages. So that's one of the beauties, by the way, of a Facebook page rather than doing it from your profile is you can talk to people under just the name of the page. So when I'm engaging in conversations, unless I've told them, they just see questions from atheists. Now, if it's somebody that I've grown to trust and have a relationship with, we'll get on some other kind of, you know, email or something, and they'll know my name. But yeah, beginning conversations, I don't want people to necessarily know who I am. It's not that I want to hide it. I'll tell them my first name, but it's not hard to find who I am either, though. So, Paul, I think you had your hand up.
There's not currently an online resource in Russia that I would endorse for a non-believer, a new believer. So we're starting. Mm.
Cool.
What is the best venue for encouraging discussion? Is it the comments on
I've seen a couple of, I can't remember the name because they were in Russian, but I've seen a couple of social media sites that are dedicated to Russia, or Russian, the Russian language. So if they're the equivalent of Facebook, I would say the best place for discussion is Facebook. And so if there's an equivalent of that there, or maybe Facebook itself. Oh, I see what you're saying. I'll tell you how it works for us is when we share a video, most of the discussion just happens right there in the comments of the video.
On Facebook?
On Facebook, yeah. Yeah, Facebook. Well, it happened on YouTube too, but Facebook seems to be where most people are. So YouTube, we get some discussion, but they're usually mean comments, and so not much discussion goes on there. And there's just a lot less of them. But on Facebook, I guess we've just gotten really used to talking there or something. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but most of the discussion happens on Facebook. So, yeah. How about you?
Are you targeting a certain demographic on your questions?
Yes, but it's not immediately clear who it is. So I get a lot of people saying, you're talking to Christians. And I'm saying, yeah. Because it says questions from atheists. It doesn't say I'm talking to atheists. This could mean that I'm talking to people who have gotten questions from atheists, other believers. And so in my mind, the people I'm targeting is folks like us who have been bombarded by questions from atheists and are trying to figure out how to answer them. And so our videos largely are, you know, they focus on that. Now, an atheist could look at them and say, oh, yeah, I get it. And I think hopefully we have a lot to do, but yeah, mostly they're targeted for believers who are going to do what we're trying to do, and that's share the gospel with atheists. And I will say, I think one of the things that makes us unique as far as an apologetics group, because that's basically what we are, is an apologetics, you know, we're making apologetics videos. There are not many apologetics groups that are coming from a free grace perspective. Most of them, from what I'm seeing, they're coming from a kind of a reformed background or something like that. And so we kind of stand unique in that, and one of the reasons I think that matters is I talk to a lot of people, like 95-98% probably of the atheists that I talk to, they grew up in church. And one of the things that I always try to do is I always try to have them sort of mirror back to me the presentation of the gospel that they received. It's always works-based. I've yet to talk to somebody that has, now I'm sure there are, I'm not, you know, not a blanket statement, but as far as I've seen, most of it is just, it's works-based, it's illogical, it's frustrating, or it's faith plus works, and they've left it because they're frustrated. They're being told by the modern age to be logical, to be reasonable, and the presentation of the gospel they heard in their church growing up just doesn't really make sense when you try to break it down. So I got off on that. Why did I go on that? I don't know. We'll talk to whoever. Yeah, we get both. We get both. Yeah. A lot of the response from atheists is just not, I would call it unpleasant. It's still positive because it's engagement, you know, but it's not necessarily pleasant. But the valuable conversations are really with other believers who are dealing with this stuff. Yeah. That's really where that's not always true, though. There's a guy, actually 2 years ago, when I was here, I started a conversation with a guy who's an atheist, still is, brilliant guy. I'll make it quick because we're almost out of time, but I just was feeling this burden. I feel like I should be talking to some atheist people, and so I found a Facebook page called Atheist Republic, hundreds of thousands of likes, and I just posted on there, I said, I'm a Christian, make fun of me. And it was like a beehive. I mean, just, I think hundreds, you know, just started. And so what I was thinking at the time was I want to connect with a few atheists that are reasonable and I can have a good conversation with. So I got about 100 different things and I tried to talk to people. And so what I did is I picked out about 10 of them and I thought, okay, we're going to go to our destination, which is the, you know, private message. And so I tried to transition some of those over to private message. Some of them said, no way. Some of them, you know, we talked for a bit. But one guy named John, who has always been an atheist from the time he was a kid, raised in a Christian home, but just it didn't make sense to him or something. And he's always been an atheist and started talking to him actually while I was at GES 2 years ago. And he started sharing stories with me and it just became a friendship. And so I consider him a friend now. Well, recently he's adopted a young guy, a young boy. He's adopted a boy. And he recently sent me this message, said, hey, I adopted, a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, maybe 7 now, and he believes in God, And I don't, and I don't know how to talk to him about it. But I want him to grow up in a very fair and open-minded house, and I don't know how to talk to him. So can you help me talk to him about God? So this is an atheist guy who, you know, I could have just written off really easy because, you know, everybody else was being mean. I just kind of assumed all atheists were mean, you know. And so, but here we are in this really interesting place where he's wanting to talk to his son about God, but he doesn't know how. And so he happens to know a guy, you know. Another interesting thing with him, he was just very open-minded. We actually read through a few chapters of John together. And this was all online. He lives in Michigan or something like that. And read through a few chapters of John. And, you know, he would say, well, it's just not really doing much for me, but it's kind of fun to talk about it, you know. And so, so that's the kind of stuff. So some atheists we have interactions with is really great. Most it isn't. Most it's pretty rough. So. Oh, wow.
But we went down there every Sunday, and the same hecklers would come out, you know, and you got to think there's something wrong with them if they come out.
Yeah.
People Sunday after Sunday. Yeah. But most of them, underneath all of that demons, they're people, and they need that. A lot of them have really deep needs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, that's, I feel like the only reason I can do what I'm doing is because I grew up between two brothers, and I just got good at, you know, just shrugging that kind of stuff off. And so for me, you know, I wake up to five or six mean comments every morning, and it's to the point where it's like, hey, you know, if I'm not getting this, I must be doing something wrong, you know. I mean, Jesus said they'll hate you because they hate me. So, but that's also not a license for me to be mean, because they could dislike me if I'm mean, and I need to distinguish between that. And so if I'm kind and I'm loving and they still are being mean, then that's beautiful. That's great. You know, that's a good thing.
But she's in some sort of group, I don't know, I think it's Calvary Chapel, but they have like some there's questions that just come up that are so common.
Yeah.
She can just click a button and put that answer in.
We've started to do that a bit because we, like you said, we notice a lot of the same questions. So, on the questions that we get a bunch, like, and this actually comes from a lot from believers, but Matthew 7, I made a few videos on that just because people kept saying it. They kept, you know, talking about that one. James 2, we made videos that we just share when somebody brings it up because they bring it up all the time. So what you're probably gathering from what I'm saying is we get a lot of resistance from other believers. And in fact, that's probably where most of our actual resistance comes from, is people that don't agree with how we share the gospel. So I don't know if it's jealousy or frustration, but here I am trying to talk to an atheist about the gospel, and the believer's coming over and saying, that's not how to do it, you know? And so I will ban people that do that immediately, because to me it just ruins the thing. I think we're probably about out of time, but I think you had your hand up a couple of times.
Quick question in terms of when you say the destination is private messaging, do you mean you using Facebook or whatever, and then at some point you say, would you like to move to texting, or what do you mean when you say moving?
I generally stay on Facebook, but yeah, I just want to.
Just do it on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to get the conversation out of the public sector.
Yeah, okay.
That's the main thing.
You switch to something else, or
you can, but it's all Facebook has such a good system.
Okay, you
yeah.
Just do it right there.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I get to know somebody really well, I may eventually share my number or something, but that rarely happens. So, yeah. So, anyways, hey. It's 2:45. That was really fun, guys. I appreciate you guys coming. This stuff is all free. It's got our websites and stuff. Anybody have kids? Would you like a children's book that me and my father made? Anybody? Anybody? Anybody?
What's the name of the video that got somebody interested?
They
would like to look that up.
If there's not a bunch of people about to come in, I could show it to you, but I'm not sure. There's probably sessions right after us, aren't there? Tell you what, if you just go to questionsfromatheist.com, it'll be right there on the main page. So, yeah.
Is your website?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So how do you, when you post something, what could they just...
Well, that's a good question. I probably should have...
How do they know who you are?
Yeah, I should have probably covered that. So I duplicate most of the activity on Facebook that I do on the website. So, so we're to the point now where Google brings people to our website. And it's got the same content that what we're doing on Facebook. But sharing stuff from our website to Facebook, I don't know, it's third-party content.
Well, it's really weird. I mean, I'm kind of doing this because I'm older. You know? But I go on Facebook, my kids, I have to ask them, what am I doing? You know? But apparently the only ones who come to my Facebook or have some kind of contact with me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't just get strangers on there. So how do you get these strangers on your Facebook?
Let me pack this up and let's talk about it. Because that is kind of the big mystery. Well, no, I don't. The answer is not so obvious, and it's not exactly obvious to me necessarily. It's just that I can tell you what's happened for us is that we had a video. Basically, what started the large audience we have is we had a video that just lots of people wanted to see, and so people that I didn't know started sharing it. But that's hard. Yeah, that's hard to get automatically, you know. So something has to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it just snowballed. I mean, it snowballed like overnight. It went from, we had maybe 15,000 views to 150,000 views the next day, and then.